Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to The Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
I know the past few episodes, we've been connecting beer with a film we have seen, you know, de rigueur. It's what we do. Mm-hmm. I wasn't in a beer mood tonight. I was in a wine mood, so I got a wine that doesn't match with anything. Just a good, actually, unlike many episodes with wine, this one's okay.
It is. It's actually a very nice red wine.
This one's just fine.
So thank you. It's a good little happy hour wine.
It's from Spain. I don't even remember what kind it is.
Is it like a Tempranillo, perhaps?
It is not a Tempranillo.
But that's all. That's the only Spanish wine I could think of right off the tip of my tongue.
And you're going to hear the cat. For whatever reason, he usually swipes at Hannah. He doesn't like Hannah. Eddie does not like Hannah, but he's likes Hannah tonight. So we're going to hear the cat. On this episode, we've got a Marvel film. We've got a musical, which is quite divisive. Mm-hmm. Stay tuned. And three documentaries. We're going to split on the documentaries. We went solo. She saw two. I saw one. We had no interest in what each other saw. But I have no doubt it will be riveting business.
That's right.
Let's start with the biggest film of the week. The Marvel movie, Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. Hannah, the 25th film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's in Phase 4. Remember, we're post-Endgame. We've done the first film, Black Widow, which was actually a prequel. It was Yonder. It was before Infinity War. We're after Endgame now. They reference the blip.
So is this considered now MCU 4?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And even though it's film 25, it's an origin story.
Of course.
It's possibly we have a new Avenger on our hands. Shang-Chi, if the title doesn't give that away. Directed by, and we've seen this guy before, Destin Daniel Cretton. He's got three films on his resume. One of them, I don't know if you saw, I loved it in 2013, the little indie film that launched 1,000 Oscar winners, Short Term 12.
Yes.
It helped launch Brie Larson, Caitlin Dever, Rami Malek, and Lakeith Stanfield.
Wow.
Wonderful film. I did not see 2017's The Glass Castle.
I think you did. That was a romantic drama, wasn't it?
Well, you're asking the wrong guy.
It rings a bell, but
When everyone saw, I guess, his latest movie, they thought, why don't we give him a Marvel martial arts movie? He also did 2019's Just Mercy.
Which I don't think I saw.
Yes, you did.
Yes, I did.
You love that guy.
I love that movie. Oh, that was the one, was that Michael B. Anthony?
It was.
Yes, I do remember that one.
It was
one.
A good film.
So those are very, very different genres.
They're huge. It's huge.
It's crazy.
That guy, and those three films, Short Term 12, The Glass Castle, and Just Mercy, led this gentleman to make Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. Now, our good friend and film guru, Christian Hammaker, he tweeted, if you like Shang-Chi, you're required, you have to go watch the three other films by Destin Daniel Cretton. Well, Christian, love you, man. I'm not going to go back and watch The Glass Castle. I'm not going to do it. But Short Term 12 and Just Mercy, yes, everybody should see them. And I'm sure everybody should see all three of these films. But so just know out there, Christian Hammaker says, You're required. You have to. Now, he didn't say what you have to do if you didn't like Shang-Chi.
Well, here's the problem is that you went and saw this movie that is definitely the biggest movie of the week on IMAX today. I was not able to see it yet, so I will have to play catch up. But I'll tell you, the folks that have run out and seen it today, I've seen nothing but positive reviews, so I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say about it.
You know, I'm with you. I've seen nothing but positive review. I'm giving one myself. It's got 92% on the tomato meter. And then I read the New York Times review, and they're in the minority on that one. They state their case, but they're in the minority. This is a prodigal son story. You've got Sean, the Americanized version of Shang-Chi. He ran away from home. He's out. Father's an assassin, wants his son to follow in his assassin footsteps. And Sean's like, nope, I'm out of here. I'm going to San Francisco and I'm going to hang out with Awkwafina. Awkwafina is Katie. She's plays the exact same character I think she does in Crazy Rich Asians. You know, the goofy goofball friend who's like kind of too much in her limited screen time.
She's awesome in that, though.
She's a lot. She's a handful.
She was a scene stealer, though, in Crazy Rich Asians.
So Sean runs away, and Dad wants him to come back home, and to do that, he sends a lot of assassins after his son. Come home, son. Here's a lot of assassins. And probably one of the best fight scene in the film takes place in San Francisco on a bus as it goes like those down those San Francisco. You know what reminded me? It reminded me of The Rock. Remember, like they had like a big chase scene going down the hills. They do that again, and it's on one of those double extended buses, and it's great. The bad guy's got a machete as an arm. It's a wonderful. It's the best chase scene in the entire film. Shang-Chi's got to go home. Dad's up to no good. Dad's the one with the 10 rings. You know, we're talking about the Legend of the 10 Rings. Dad's got 10 rings on his arms. He's 1,000 years old. The 10 rings make you immortal. Dad's been around.
Yeah.
Shang-Chi's got a sister, catches up with her. She runs like a fight club, like an underground fight club in Macau, and they both wind up back with Dad because Dad says, your dead mom's alive. Your mom's alive. And go get her. Let's go get her. She's back at her mystical village, Ta Lo, which is kind of like Wakanda. It's not on any map. No maps. Uh-huh. It's like it might even be in another dimension.
Okay.
I'm gonna go get mom. Hey, bygones. Bygones. I know your childhood was terrible, and I know I like tried to kill you a couple times, but bygones. Let's go get mom. And they're like, Dad, mom's dead. Mom's dead. And they get to the village before him. We meet Michelle Yeoh. she's
crazy
like,
rich Asian.
She's the same character from Crouching Tiger. She's got those same dramatic martial arts moves that can move like wind around and stuff. It's a Crouching Tiger homage. It's wonderful. And so Dad comes to attack the village. Gotta save the village. Save the villagers. This is a Marvel popcorn movie. Remember Ant-Man? Like Ant-Man was, yes, he's an Avenger, but he's goofy.
Yeah.
It's funny. And it's like a summertime popcorn movie. This is one of those. This is not as goofy as Ant-Man, but it's got Awkwafina in it. And it's a summertime popcorn film. It's not heavy. It's not Infinity War. It's not Endgame. It's Ant-Man, and it's about as enjoyable as Ant-Man. It's a lesser, I want to say it's lesser Marvel. Maybe it's because I don't know the guy.
I mean, that sometimes is what happens when it's that origin story. Somebody, a comic character that we haven't really heard of before. But what I was reading was that this can sort of do for Asian representation, what Black Panther did for Black representation in like a superhero movie. And so again, this sort of just is a launching pad for these other characters. And so, you know, it's basically Marvel and martial arts, which I think is sort of the first time that we're really seeing martial arts being front and center, sort of a kung fu character Avenger. So I will eventually catch up with it. Right now, I believe it's only in theaters.
It is. Theaters have a 45-day exclusive theatrical release. They didn't do this what they did with Black Widow. Maybe it's because of, you know, certain legal shenanigans. But after 45 days, then you, on Disney Plus, you can get it with Premier Access.
Oh, you still have to pay the additional. That's
well,
wrong.
TBD.
Perhaps.
This is not simultaneous Disney Plus with Premier Access. So in 45 days, in 44 days,
okay,
you'll find out. Maybe you can see it. So yes, it is Marvel's first film with an Asian lead. I could see one criticism that I saw. I think this was from the Times, and I can see what they're saying. Shang-Chi is not as interesting as the supporting characters around him. Like his Fight Club running sisters, actually a bit more interesting. His dad, his 1,000-year-old dad, is way more interesting than Shang-Chi. I'm not saying he's stiff, but there are, you know, maybe he's more Captain America than Iron Man.
But I wasn't a huge, huge fan of Captain America the first time I saw him appear. And so the first Captain America film did not blow me away as much as the future ones did. And as I saw that character development and then interaction with other Avengers, that's when I became a huge Cap fan. So I can see how, you know, we might just need to kind of give it a little breathing room and see how the character develops within the Marvel universe. So I definitely, being a Marvel fan and an Avengers fan, I certainly will eventually catch up and watch this one. So it is on my list. And I do think that when you just hear essentially universal praise for something like that among superhero movie fans, I think there's that caveat that if you're not already into that genre, then I don't think it's as exciting. But if you are looking for a fresh film in that superhero genre, then it definitely sounds like Shang-Chi's the one to see. And make sure you stick around, from what I hear, for at least one, if not two, end credit scenes.
It's not a standalone film. I'm not going to give any spoilers. I'm not going to tell you who it is. But two people you've seen before in Avengers films show up in the film, like as characters. You've seen them, you know who they are. I will not tell you who they are. There are two credit stingers. One almost right off the bat, which is a doozy. You have to see it. It connects everything. And then there's one like all the way at the end, like mm-hmm. the 11 minutes of credits go. And then there's one all the way at the end. You need to see that too. Mm-hmm. Okay. Break. Here's the one that's tearing certain critic circles apart. And it shouldn't. We know this story. You know the plot. And I haven't even told you the movie yet. It's Cinderella. Guarantee you know what it's about. What you don't know is that it's written and directed by Kay Cannon. You don't really know her as a director. You've seen her one directorial credit before this, 2018's Blockers.
I liked Blockers.
It was funny. Mm-hmm. It was funny. I laughed. It wasn't great. I laughed.
It was fun.
But the reason you know this is Kay Cannon is because she wrote three Pitch Perfects, mm-hmm. which really, it didn't introduce it, but it really solidified the mashup. The song, I'm listening to a song and all of a sudden it's another song. The song mashup, which might play a role in Cinderella. Cinderella films come along frequently. Yes. What's going on with this one? What's the hook? What's the catch? Why are people talking about this Cinderella?
Well, this Cinderella is not your Rodgers and Hammerstein Cinderella. And so if you are going into this being like, ooh, I can't wait to hear how it sounds with, you know, the cute little In My Own Little Corner, In My Own Little Chair song, you're not going to get that. This is a modern take on Cinderella. And so it takes this traditional story that we all know, but the heroine, Ella, played by Camila Cabello, is this ambitious young woman with big dreams. So she's not all in to marry a prince. You know, it's not just about meeting and marrying a prince. It's about, hey, I'm going to go to this ball so I can do some major networking to advance my ambitions to have a career as a fashion designer and travel the world. And so the divisiveness has really shocked me about this film, because maybe I just was in the mood. I was in the mood for fluff. And that's what this is. This is just a light, entertaining, different take. Ironically, the idea for this particular story of Cinderella was from James Corden. Mm. It came from James Corden, who is a producer on the film and is in it playing a mouse and that turns into a footman for the going to the ball. It's got Billy Porter as the sort of, I would say, asexual fairy godmother. I don't know what non-genderized, instead she's the fabulous godparent, Fab G. And so there's just a lot in this film, in this version, that's really meant to, I'd say, be almost a little spoofy of fairy tale films. And the music, as I said, it's a much more modern kind of hip sort of musical adaptation. You've got Idina Menzel playing the stepmother. I mean, anytime you have Idina Menzel opening her mouth and singing in any film, then you know you've at least got 10 minutes of a music-worthy movie. And so I just enjoyed it. The people who are just bashing it, I don't get it. I just think that you have to kind of take it all with a grain of salt. And it's like watching any of the Hallmark Christmas movies or the Netflix Christmas movies, that just holiday movies that pop up, or just those just candy. It's just cinematic candy. It's probably not terribly good for you if you're a film critic, but if you're just a movie viewer, if you're the audience that's just looking for just a fun new twist on a age-old fairy tale that's been retold a million times, then I think to be able to watch Cinderella on, if not in theaters, then on Amazon Prime right now, it's just an easy watch to me. But man, some people have just hated it. And Charlie, I don't know yet where you fall on that spectrum.
Well, I want to use your last sentence as a transition. Our cinematic friend, Eddie Passa, he writes for DCFilmdom.com, which is where you can find his output. I want to read you snippets. I saw his tweets. I'm like, mm-hmm. Whoa, this is very... Eddie's not usually like this.
Yeah.
This struck a chord with Eddie. Not the same chord it struck with you. So I'm going to read you something from him, and mm-hmm. I want to see you be like, no, that's wrong, Eddie, it's wrong. Or it's like, no, I can see where he's coming from.
Uh-huh.
All right, here you go. Eddie Passa says, no thought put into it, from the casting to the sets and art direction to the photography and to the performances. It's all thrown together to capitalize on what's hot.
Yeah.
He hated everything.
He did.
Everything.
He did. And we had a little offline discussion about that. And basically, I think Eddie and I agreed that, well, we're just not really going to see eye to eye on this particular one, that that it suited what I was looking for at the moment. And he obviously just watched it and did not get what he was hoping for out of it. I think my expectations were way lower going in. And I love any, which is surprising because Eddie and I both love, music in movies. So we completely agreed on something like The Greatest Showman we both loved. So I was kind of taken aback at just how much he disliked this film. But I looked it up. So it's got 44% on Rotten Tomatoes among the critics, but it's got 84%. On the audience score. And so that means...
They haven't even seen it yet. Like 20 people have seen this.
No, it's been on... No, because I mean it's...
It's been out for like 24 hours.
but regardless though, even if you have a consensus, if you have 80 critics who have written reviews and it gets a 44%. So I always say 4 out of 10. So I'm one of 4 out of 10 critics. 4 out of 10 reviewers that... would have given it, that just enjoyed it for what it was. So the other 6 to me are, sort of bah humbug about it. And you still haven't told me what you think of it, Charlie.
I went in with lower expectations than you did. Uh-huh. I'm tired of Cinderella. I'm tired. Like, it's a story that has been done. I don't care how fresh you make it, how 2021 and Fab G, and she's not looking to get married, she's looking to be an entrepreneur, you make it. It's still Cinderella.
Mm-hmm.
So, I didn't hate it.
Yeah.
I was amused. The best part about it for me was the mashups. I was very amused when all of a sudden I heard Rhythm Nation and Desiree's Ya Gotta Be. I was like, okay, well, if the worst that could happen is this introduces some 11-year-old to Janet Jackson's Rhythm Nation, then maybe it's got some for it. And then I heard In Vogue's What a Man and the White Stripes' Seven Nation Army.
Uh-huh.
That was walking a fine line. They parroted, they tried to do Lin-Manuel Miranda with the Town Crier. A little bit too much of a ripoff for me. And I thought we learned our lesson with Mamma Mia. You don't put Pierce Brosnan in a musical. You don't do it.
They did learn their lesson. They don't let Pierce sing.
He sang.
No, but very minimally.
He sang.
Very minimally, and it was obvious that he was not supposed to be good.
And Ella Enchanted already did Somebody to Love, so they stole that song. And that one, that's a whole Cinderella film with contemporary music in it. So this is derivative. It's already derivative, Cinderella fairy tale, and it's derivative after Ella Enchanted. So no, I would be a critic giving this a Rotten Tomato, but I'm not like Eddie Passa hate it.
Right.
I'm just regular Charlie hate it.
And that was my prediction. when talking to Eddie. He's like, I'll be really curious to see where Charlie falls on the spectrum, because I did think you would not hate it.
I didn't.
I watched it thinking...
But I didn't like it.
But... But that's typical. So, so that was expected. But what I wanted to make sure was that you didn't hate it.
No.
Because there really are elements to this that are just absolutely fluffy, fun entertainment.
Well, fluffy is not a positive. When you say fluffy, that's like a check mark, check plus for you.
But no.
Not for me.
No, but I do, I just... To me, it's like watching one of those just sort of Netflix binges that around the holidays. That's what this is.
And
this
I
is
know like you any, love that. I know.
It's when I'm just in the mood for it. And so this film caught me when that's all I wanted. I just wanted an easy...
You want that every week for every film.
No.
You want a fluffy, easy film.
No, because some of these other films that we're about to talk about, I was trying to get you to watch something serious, and you're like, I don't want to watch that.
We'll get to that. Yeah.
So I would... I disagree with that. It's just that I think I had been watching a lot of heavier stuff, and so this was just a nice little departure, and again, Idina Menzel's a stepmother, and this is just sort of, I would call it a somewhat refreshing take. There's a different character introduced, the prince's sister, who's like this socially conscientious, she's ahead of her time as well.
She's 2021 personified.
She is 2021 personified in whatever era this actually is supposed to be happening in. The king and the queen, you have Minnie Driver. Playing,
you'll see her a lot.
The queen, we haven't seen her in quite some time, and so there are a lot of very strong female characters in this film, and it's really all about Ella is going to stick to her general game plan, but the romance between the royal and the commoner is still very much a strong part of the narrative. You're not getting rid of that because it's still Cinderella.
It's a part of the narrative,
But, I can see the pitch perfect kind of overtones to this, that was infused into this idea. And so I just think you got to enjoy it for the light ride that it is and not try to take it so seriously because, you've got Idina Menzel, I think, singing Material Girl after telling the stepsisters who are ogling the hot neighbor who's the farm boy, and they're like,
no. Just because you're not supposed to take a film seriously doesn't mean it still must be critiqued on its merits.
No, but I enjoyed the music, and I enjoyed the performances, so I liked, and I enjoyed some of the dialogue. And Billy Porter, it was just...
You've been there for like 4 minutes.
I know, it wasn't much. It was actually less Billy Porter than I think I would have expected based on what a big deal was being made during production about having this this new twist on the fairy godmother role. But it was just an escape. And so if you've got Amazon Prime, it's not like you're paying some $30 premium fee to watch this. It's like, if you don't like the first half hour, it's Amazon Prime. You can turn it off.
Okay.
It's okay.
So, transition. A main supporting character here is Adele Dazeem. She cut her chops. She made her name on Broadway, in Idina. Fact. And, yes, Idina Menzel, not Adele Dazeem. You love yourself some Broadway.
I
don't get up to Broadway a lot. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen a show on Broadway.
Nobody's been there for the past 18 months.
Nobody. But you saw a documentary that I had no interest in seeing this week called actually On Broadway. So what's going on Broadway?
Yeah, so this documentary is rolling out basically simultaneously with the reopening of Broadway after being dark for 18 months. They were really hard hit by COVID. But this documentary was obviously all shot before COVID. And so it is really for Broadway aficionados, for like my drama major niece, who sees tons and tons of plays and musicals on Broadway. That's what this is. This is a documentary that is a tribute to what Broadway's history has been and what it's overcome in the past, and how it ebbs and flows with what's big on Broadway. How the commercialization of Broadway to some degree after Times Square was completely cleaned up. And you just see just the perspective of a whole bunch of people. My buddy Hugh Jackman's in there because he'll be in The Music Man coming up on Broadway this year. James Corden is in that again because he's a big Broadway guy. Andrew Lloyd Webber. You find out about all these sort of pivot points since like the 1940s and 50s, the heyday of the old Broadway musical, and then what it took for Broadway to survive when they sort of ended up losing big chunks of their audience, how it became more for tourists in like the 80s and the 90s than for New Yorkers, and how the pricing has really left out a huge amount of people. But I'm guilty. I'm watching this thing going, yeah, I'm guilty of being one of those ones who really love those big blockbuster musicals, the jukebox musicals, as they're called. But there's this whole other set of people who are really, who are all about the plays on Broadway and the range and the experimental theater. And you see how A Chorus Line was originally workshopped in a nonprofit theater before it got to Broadway, and people weren't so sure that it had any chance of success whatsoever. And yet it became, like, for years and years, the longest-running musical on Broadway. Hamilton ended up really doing the same kind of, almost like a parallel track, being workshopped before it went to Broadway and being in a nonprofit public theater. And then suddenly, you know, it goes to Broadway and finds all these audiences. And it's just an example of how you don't know what's going to always work, that you always need to start with a really good story. And then it's business. It's show business. And you never quite know for sure what's going to happen. But it was just interesting to just see all these different perspectives. But it's very much a movie for theater buffs, theater historians, and just the more you know about Broadway and the more you've seen in the past, the more you're likely to really enjoy this film. So it's not for you, which is why I didn't make you watch it.
I mean, I've seen musicals. I've been to London's West End. I've been to the Kennedy Center. I've just never been to Broadway.
But that's just it. This is Broadway. Broadway is the character. It's like it. You don't have any of those other things without the living thing that is and has been Broadway for years. And so to see just how the transformation of where the theaters were when it was a really seedy neighborhood to be in, and that nobody would want to walk down 42nd Street after hours, and just how things evolved. And there's different, some people really miss the old Times Square and the old theater district with all its seediness. But then you had people like Helen Mirren, who are interviewed for this film, who really talk about just how they love that energy of New York and Times Square, and that there's just no comparison to it. And so I do think that's, that's what you're getting. I remember they talk about how a lot of times they need these big bankable stars in plays now to survive. And it's like, yeah, I went and saw Network on Broadway because Bryan Cranston was in it. I definitely, I went and saw To Kill a Mockingbird because Jeff Daniels was starring in it. And so there is that draw, and I am probably one of the reasons for some of that transformation. But I do think it's ridiculous when you realize just how crazy expensive tickets have gotten and how it did force a sea change in who can see these things. If you don't have a few hundred bucks to get a good seat on Broadway for a Broadway show, then you're not going to see them, and that's a shame. So,
well, while you're watching Broadway, I was watching The Big Scary S Word. S is for socialism.
Ooh, exciting.
So, well, I was a poli-sci major in international relations, master's, whatever. Anyways, historians, journalists, and politicians reveal that, contrary to popular belief, socialism is in fact deeply American. Mm-hmm. And it's quite convincing. Policies championed by socialists have taken root and become accepted orthodoxy, especially labor rights. Your weekends and your eight-hour workday, socialism. Your Social Security and Medicare, socialism. Mm-hmm. In fact, socialists, the Republican Party, which started in Wisconsin as a very, very, very far-left party, spawned the socialist movement. So saying, thank you, Republicans. We appreciate it. I'm not saying I'm a socialist. I'm just saying the Republican Party spawned socialism. So well done to you. The most famous interview is Cornel West. We've seen him before. The former Harvard professor. He's good. He's got a little fire in his gut on this one. He names off all the famous people you know who actually you didn't know were socialists. Don't get fooled by the marketing. There is no sit-down interview with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Bernie Sanders. They're both in it, but, you know, like as in new show snippets or stump speeches, there's no one-on-one
that's
talking
cheating.
Head.
That's
it
cheating.
Looks like they're in it.
Yes.
But they're not.
That's just cheating. That's wrong.
If you remember the Oklahoma teacher strike from a few years ago, that's a central mm-hmm. focal point. So is a Virginia state delegate. He was elected in the 50th district, which I think is up here somewhere in Northern Virginia, as a socialist in the Virginia House of Delegates. I had no idea that was a thing. This documentary functions best as a history lesson. It works so good when they're like, okay, back here, back then, we did this, we did that, we did it, and that's why we have what we have today. Thank you, socialism. It does not work as great when it's contemporary, when we're at the annual socialist convention, or we're following around the Oklahoma State teacher. That's a little bit drier. So, and this isn't a great documentary, but it works as one of those learning, like I learned something documentaries.
Uh-huh.
So I'm on board for this documentary, Hannah.
Yeah, well, so I was like, history of Broadway or history of socialism?
Indeed.
Which one do I want to watch, Cinderella?
And we fit in our in our buckets. We went into our safe zones.
We went into our safe zones, but the one that I really wanted you to watch that you took a pass on.
Oh, God.
Was, when I was saying that I don't just watch fluff, that I was actually needing sort of an escape from
still
some
in your bucket
though,
because you're a news lady at heart.
Exactly. So this was in my news bucket, was to watch 9/11 Inside the President's War Room. Now, over the past 20 years, I have seen plenty of the 9/11 documentaries, the ones where it's hard to watch. It's just sad as all get out. It brings me back to the day. It's just incredibly distressing. People like flying out of the windows and the audio, hearing the audio from phone calls and all of that. This is not that, and that's why I wanted to give it a check.
What is this?
So this is on Apple TV. You can see it now, but it's if you don't have Apple TV, they're actually going to allow you to watch it on September 11th for free. In honor of to commemorate the 20th anniversary of 9/11. But so what this does is it explores all the events of 9/11, but through the eyes of President Bush and his closest advisors on that day. Because, you know, for those who remember, Bush was at a elementary school in Florida reading to children when someone whispers in his ear, you know, that America's under attack. And so to hear Bush himself describing what he was feeling and what he was hearing and how they made the decisions that they made from that point on in consultation with some of his advisors in Washington at the time, that he was not to come back to Washington, that Air Force One was just kind of in the air while they were trying to figure out where to land and where to sort of reset and figure out what was, you know, what they were going to do. And Bush, in the meantime, was like, I want to go back to Washington. I want to go back to Washington. And people were telling him, you can't right now. You know, we're under attack. We don't know. Air Force One could be a target. And so there's all these, you know, the photos and the footage are all about what was happening, you know, Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell was somewhere. And with our good buddy Dick Cheney.
An undisclosed location.
What was happening with Dick Cheney. But I really, it just offered a completely different perspective for me on these, on the key decisions that were being made in the immediate aftermath of the planes flying into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and Pennsylvania. There's Ted Olson's in it talking about that 9/11 was his birthday and his wife was, you know, had postponed her trip until that following day, until 9/11. And so she was on one of the planes. And so to hear his perspective of sort of knowing that all this stuff was going on and that chances are his wife's plane was among those that were lost, it just to me was such a gripping drama to watch unfold without all that additional horror that we have to endure, and that it's worth enduring if you haven't seen them at all. But I really appreciated. I don't think I'd ever heard this much directly from Bush about what was happening from his perspective, and so. It was a really engrossing documentary, and so I chose to watch that. I mentioned to you earlier tonight that there's a new movie out called Worth, with Michael Keaton playing the guy who then was dispensing the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund, and I was like, okay, I'm hearing really good things about that movie, but I can't watch more than one, like, 9/11-centric film in a given week with the anniversary approaching. So I did choose to watch this documentary. And so I just think that if you're interested in that perspective from sort of that senior advisors and the president himself and what was going on, and just seeing something slightly different. It's just amazing that you have real drama. It's like the most dramatic kind of documentary you can ever watch, because it's all so, it's been 20 years and yet it still feels in many ways pretty fresh.
Not only did I have no interest in seeing it, I will never have any interest in seeing this film. I remember 9/11. I was a senior in college. Therefore, I had nothing to do with it. Although I ended up eventually serving in both wars spawned by 9/11, one of them completely unnecessary. Unlike the 12 Marines and one Navy corpsman who we just lost in Kabul, who have no memory of 9/11. They don't remember a thing about it because they were all babies and children. Therefore, I have no interest in watching the particular cabal of politicians run around with scared looks upon their faces.
But that's not what it is.
I don't care where they were that day. Like, I don't care where they were. I don't care what they were doing. I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't want to know.
That's the difference. So this will be incredibly appealing to some people and incredibly not to others. So that's where we do have a divide. But, I mean, you can't slam something that you haven't seen.
I don't want to see their faces. I don't want to hear their voices. I know what they sound like. I know what they look like. And I really don't want to see them.
Yeah. Well, it's not that believe me, I was not by any chance, you know, I'm a pure Democrat all the way. And I've always had my issues with Bush and certainly with Cheney and how things evolved after that. But I still, because from the news perspective, from having lived that day in the news world, having really witnessed moment by moment what was going on, hearing the phone calls from the State Department and the White House of people evacuating and not really knowing what was going on, seeing the second plane hit, seeing the smoke outside the office window at the Pentagon down, you know, up the road. It's just different people have their own lens through which they watch stuff about that time and that day. And so this is for probably more so the journalism types and just some political, you know, you talk about being a poli-sci major. This is good for current poli-sci majors to watch. And it just is, I think, a different perspective. So to each his own. I can like Cinderella, and I can like 9/11 inside the president's war room.
It just shows the breadth of your appreciation of film. I did watch something this week that I immediately shot to you because I knew it would also be in your wheelhouse. Now, you haven't been watching this series like I have, this docuseries, Watch the Sound with Mark Ronson. I watched episode 4 this week called Synthesizers, and when immediately after it finished, I blared at an unnecessarily loud level Duran Duran's Save a Prayer. And it was so good, and I understood just so much more about that song. And I immediately shot you a Facebook message like, Hannah, I know you haven't been watching this show, but check out episode 4, Duran Duran, Gary Numan, and it turns out everyone really who invented synthesizers was a woman. You've got to watch this episode all about the wonderful world of synthesizers, and your boy shows up again,
Paul McCartney, who actually I realized as I was watching Paul McCartney in this episode of Watch the Sound with Mark Ronson, that I'm like, I think he could have just inserted any of these Paul McCartney sound bites in any of the actual episodes, because he says things like, you've got to allow progress. Just roll with it.
No, he was talking about synthesizers on Maxwell's silver hammer.
But I feel like he says that in every episode, whether it's about... I've seen two. And so I hate to break it to you, but I hated synthesized music. Oh, God. It just wasn't, even in the 80s.
When that Duran Duran song popped on, you didn't feel that?
No, I'm okay with the Duran Duran, but a lot of the other just reminded me, I had these flashbacks to like these really bad bar mitzvah parties in the 80s with the synthesized music, dance music playing, and the electronic music. And so electronic music was just never my thing, even in the 80s. And so what I did appreciate, but it felt buried until all of a sudden it shifted gears to talk about the women.
Yeah.
All of a sudden you are. It's like
Delia Derbyshire.
But these women didn't get their proper due at the time.
Did they ever?
No. And so they are saying that, Delia Derbyshire, she said she thinks she was a feminist before feminist was invented. I think she was British. And talked about
good Lord.
She was very British. She was very British in her.
Well, she worked for the BBC and had a hand in creating the theme song of Doctor Who. She's British.
Yes, and so that was very cool. And then she talked about how, as a kid, the air raid sirens were like to her electronic music that triggered for her like a sound connection. And so I still, this is just still not
this
a doc.
Right in your wheelhouse.
It was not.
You were so there.
I liked snippets of it, but I still, this docuseries is still, it's for the Charlies. It's for the audiophiles. It is for people who like to dissect music. I'm not a dissector. I'm not a dissector of film to the extent that that you are. I'm not a dissector of music to the extent that you are. And so while I did appreciate the snippets about, oh my gosh, there really were women that that were the pioneers and the forefront of this kind of music and sound. But and here's Paul McCartney. Hey.
Why does Paul McCartney engender such hate in it?
I love Paul McCartney, but it feels forced. To me, it just feels like he's forced. It's like we haven't put our Paul McCartney soundbite into this episode yet. And so you can tell it was all like one sit-down interview with Paul McCartney.
And he probably deliberately talked about reverb
exactly.
And the synthesizers in the other.
I know.
And it's not piecemeal. It actually fits.
They
were playing on a synthesizer.
I know.
You can't play that in the reverb episode.
I know. But I appreciate where you're coming from with liking this series. But you need to be a music lover, a music maker. This is the series for you. I mean, it absolutely should be watched and enjoyed.
I just assumed you would have been the world's biggest Duran Duran fan.
No, I like Duran Duran, but Duran Duran was a minimal part of this.
You're more of a Village People person. I forgot.
No, I was more Air Supply in the 80s. I'll be sure and give you that album.
Your defense is Air Supply. Pardon me.
No, and Hall & Oates. I was listening to a lot of Hall & Oates. And I loved, there's some 80s music I absolutely loved. But to me, when they pointed out, I think there was like a Donna Summer song in there.
I Feel Love,
but that wasn't, I had Donna Summer, I had the album on the radio, and to me, the songs that were in that, the electronic ones were not my favorites. My favorites were the ones that were sort of your more standard ballady kind of things. So that was not my music of choice even back in the 80s. I liked the top 40 stuff, but this to me is still another little snippet of let's completely parse this type of genre, and it just wasn't my favorite. It just wasn't my cup of tea in the 80s, so there wasn't as much for me to latch onto with this as there was for you and your wall of vinyl.
All right. Just know I'm a little crestfallen.
I'm sorry. And then I did start watching the Val Kilmer documentary. We talk about the 80s.
Talk about the 80s. I know you love your boy Val.
So I'm like, if I'm going to have to watch something from the 80s, which I must point out, the latest Top Gun Maverick release date, now it's Memorial Day weekend of 2022. Pushed yet again to May 27th. Put it on your calendars. It may or may not happen. Top Gun Maverick. But so I was watching I only got through the first few minutes. I have to go back and finish. But there's a documentary on, I believe it's on Amazon Prime, called Val. And it's Val Kilmer. And his story, it's just kind of fascinating. And when you see just all that he's gone through, and he's had tons and tons and tons of behind the scenes footage and home videos and some behind the scenes Top Gun stuff. So, talk about my era. You know, that was Val Kilmer back in the day. But it's been a rough ride for him.
I can't believe we started this episode with Shang-Chi. I feel put through the ringer. It's kind of heavy, man. It's kind of heavy.
Sorry.
All right. Anything else?
No, I think that's more than enough.
All right. And there's more than enough for everybody. You got your Shang-Chi. You got your Cinderella. Love to hear your thoughts on that, audience, by the way. See where you land on that one. Three documentaries. And synthesizers.
That's right.
And Val on the end.
And Val. And a little bit of Val.
And Adele Dazeem.
A Val chaser.
All right. So thank you very much for listening to this most intrepid episode of the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.